bricks are made of marble, with a guard and a great door, and the bolts are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. This is John Weeks, and welcome to Economic Insights for the 99%, a program that every week for 30 minutes helps people understand the economic news the mainstream media misreports, misinterprets, and misrepresents with impressive consistency. This week I'll look at events in Greece and what they mean for the rest of Europe and especially Britain. But first, who I am, since this is my first program. I'm a retired professor of economics. I taught for 20 years at SOAS, University of London. I was born in Austin, Texas. You might have caught the accent. And I live in London. I advise governments and international agencies on economic policy, and in the process discovered and continuously rediscovered the unrelentingly reactionary nature of the mainstream economics profession. My mission in this program is to expose and refute the troglodyte economics that continually bombards people everywhere with nonsense and half-truths and outright lies, always presented as the deep wisdom of economists. Economists claim to know a lot when you hear them on the radio or see them on television. In fact, they know almost nothing, and what they do know is usually reactionary and misleading. Each program will have at least two parts. First, grabbing your attention with recent headline economic events, often with a guest to help us understand them. And second, a common sense and non-technical explanation of the economic analysis that underlies the issues which we've been discussed during the program. So today we look at a mini earthquake, or maybe it might be a maxi earthquake, in politics and economics in Europe, the insurrection in Greece, where last Sunday, at the end of January, the left-wing party Syriza won an election throughout the old guard and won that election on the promise of an end of austerity and a government which would no longer be subservient to pressures coming out of Brussels, Berlin, and Washington. But I'll come back to that because we need some background to understand why we are at this point in Greece and in Europe. World War II is a good place to begin because it set the tone, you might say, for the relationship between Germany and Greece. Germany invaded Greece in 1941, occupied it for 3 years, and tens of thousands of innocent Greeks and insurgents were killed during that occupation, leaving a very bad taste in the mouths of Greeks, indeed, with regard to cooperation, you might say, with Germany. So that's a background between Greece and Germany, very fraught, though it was long ago. But it is related to another piece of background that we need, namely that why what we call the European Union, why was it formed? It's easy to find out. We can go back to the documents immediately after World War II and in the early 1950s. And it's stated clearly that the main purpose of what would become the European Union was to prevent a war among European powers in the future. Europeans had been at each other's throats for hundreds of years, and the purpose of the European, what would become the European Union, was supposed to be to prevent that from happening again and to develop a cooperative Europe in which development and progress was shared out in a cooperative and mutually supportive way. Not to put a fine point on it, the major purpose of the European Union was to prevent any country from ever dominating Europe again, preventing any European, continental European country from attempting to take over the entire continent. And of course, Germany was very much in mind, because from the point of view of the other countries, particularly the French, it had attempted to dominate Europe for at least 100 years, from the middle of the 19th century to the end of World War II. So that's where the European Union came from, and it is made all the more ironic that that was the purpose of the European Union, because, of course, it has turned out to be the European Union and its associated currency, common currency, the euro, which was introduced at the end of the 1990s and actually started circulating in 2000, that currency, and it has turned out to be the vehicle by which German capital, German business, again dominates Europe. But that's getting a little bit of ahead of the story, because how it presupposes the current power relationships which we have now, which very recently were not not what characterized Europe. If we go back to the 1990s, the German economy was not doing particularly well. A number of unwise economic decisions had been made at the time of unification, which led to the stagnation of the economy and relatively high unemployment. As a result of that, there was a general feeling among the political elite in Germany that something had to be done, something dramatic had to be done to turn the German economy around. And what was done was a deal struck between the social democratic government of the time in the late 1990s, German trade unionists, and German big business, big capital, to pursue what might euphemistically be called, what euphemistically was called, a export-led economic strategy. In fact, it was old-fashioned mercantilism, and the precise way in which this mercantilism manifested itself were, first, the trade unions agreed to hold real wages constant. So that meant that while in other parts of Europe you had rising wages, rising standard of living for the working class and for the middle class, in Germany, the real wages of workers would be frozen. Second, the trade unions agreed to have a dual labor market, such that immigrant workers from Greece and from Turkey and from the less developed parts of Southern Europe and Western Asia, that they could be paid less than Germans for the same job. So this allowed for German business to lower its costs through, you might say, legalized wage cutting. Further, to complement that wage freeze and that dual labor market, the German government, under the Social Democrats, introduced a number of tax changes which, in effect, reduced the taxation on exports. In other words, they changed the tax structure such that exports were subsidized. It's not difficult to guess what the outcome of this was. In the year 2000, recently United Germany was running a overall trade deficit with the rest of Europe of about 50 billion euro. 7 years later, 2007, 2008, it was running a surplus of 250 billion euro. So from a slight deficit, relatively to Germany's total exports, that wasn't a very big deficit, wasn't worth worrying about. So from a relatively small deficit, it went to an enormous surplus. Now, when one country runs a surplus, somebody else runs a deficit. And who are running the deficits? The other European countries. With almost no exception, the other European members of the European Union found themselves going into a trade deficit with the Germans. All right, so that's where we were when the economic crisis came along. And when it hit, it swept through Europe like a firestorm and generated downturns in every economy in the European Union. In this context, governments throughout Europe found themselves with large debts, which they had to service. And the important thing about that is that they all had to service them in the same currency, the euro. And they were all running deficits in trade with Germany. Now reflect upon that for a moment, the situation. The situation was that all of these governments found themselves needing to pay off the service their debts. They needed euros to do it, but they were running a trade deficit with Germany. So there was actually an outflow of euros from the deficit countries, the surplus countries, i.e. Germany. How do you solve this problem? The way you solve this problem is you borrow. So governments began to borrow, and private banks and companies. If a company needed to import parts to produce something, then it would have to do so by borrowing euros. And where did they borrow? Well, it's not hard to figure it out. They borrowed where there were surplus euros, namely Germany. So we had a very obvious relationship, Germany running a trade surplus, economy starting to contract and having debt service problems, needing to borrow money and borrowing them from Germany. And Greece was the most extreme case. It was probably the most vulnerable economy in Europe. And that was because of several reasons, which I'll mention only briefly. But basically, after the Greek military coup, and then the return to democratic rule under the Social Democrats under a man named Papandreou, whose father and whose son were also prime ministers of Greece, that under the Social Democrats, a deal was struck. The right in Greece, the civilian right, which the military represented, agreed to let the Social Democrats rule as long as they, the rich, didn't have to pay taxes. And this presented a rather serious problem to the Social Democrats because somehow they had to fund their social programs, even though Greece had a quite modest welfare state. Even at the time of the crisis in 2008, it had a quite modest welfare state. But in order to fund it, it had to run a deficit and borrow. Once it joined the euro, it had to borrow in euros, and it was borrowing from Germany. In 2000, the Greek debt was 140 billion euro. 2008, the Greek debt was 264 billion euro. That difference of over 100 billion, and I'll try not to, wade into too much of a swamp of numbers, the difference was almost entirely accounted for by the Greek trade deficit, which was being covered by borrowing from Germany, from France also, but primarily from Germany. So here we come to the great crisis, 2008. The Greek's government is in debt. The economy begins to collapse. German banks are holding the debt. So what strategy then is followed to try to save the Greek economy from this terrible fate of collapse? The strategy followed was that the Greek government would continue to pay its debts, and the moving spirit behind that uncompromising view of no debt relief back in 2008, 2009, 2010, the moving spirit, the strongest moving spirit behind it, you might say the driver of that position was, you guessed it, the German government, now under Angela Merkel. The Germans would claim, and they continue to claim, I should say the German government, because it's not everybody in Germany, the German government would claim that the funds extended to Greece since 2010 to the Greek government have in fact been extremely generous. So far from milking the Greek economy, that actually Germany, through its own largesse and through that of the European Union and the IMF, has been pouring money into Greece. This is complete nonsense. Of the what are called bailout funds, but at any rate, the funds which are formally extended to the Greek government over the last 5 years, 230 billion euros, 11% remain in Greece, in the Greek public sector. That is only 11 pence out of every pound did anything which remotely could be interpreted as reaching to the Greek people. And what happened to the other 89%? Well, 67% of it went to pay overseas private banks, most of them in Germany. 3% went to pay the International Monetary Fund, and 19% went to recapitalize Greek banks. So all of this largesse that came from the European Union, what it was basically doing is ensuring the bailout of banks in Germany, to a lesser extent in France, and to a much lesser extent in Greece. So that support was for nothing more than to ensure that banks didn't go bust as a result of having lent to the Greek government. And almost none of it reached any Greek on the street. Okay. That then raises the question, what was the impact on the Greek economy? Well, the impact on the Greek economy was absolutely dire. See, in order for the Greek government to be able to repay the loans, which were coming from the European Union, via pressure from the German government, that 240 billion, in order to repay it, it had to run a budget surplus. The way to run a budget surplus is either to raise taxes or to cut expenditures. Since the Greek elite was not about to start paying more taxes, that's not why they borrowed in the first place. That's not why they got into this game, along with the German government, the German banks. Cut public services. And they are cut beyond what we can imagine. Hospitals without medicine, schools without books, streets not being clean, just an unbelievable array, which you can read about, and I don't need to go into in painful detail. For the average household in Greece, the decline in per capita income, or the decline in per capita consumption, I should say, household consumption, between 2009 and now, was close to 50%. And in addition to that, the cuts in public services. So when you add private consumption declining, you might say public provision declining, it was a very bad situation indeed. So it is hardly surprising that Syriza, a party promising to eliminate austerity, it is hardly surprising that they would have been elected just a few weeks ago. Now, They had also run in 2012 when they had come in as the second largest party, and we might say it was pretty bad then. In fact, at that time, I wrote that I thought that Greece was on the brink of default, but Syriza did not win, and the reason they didn't win is because of a concerted campaign throughout Europe to terrify the Greek people into believing that if there was any wavering by the government from austerity policies and paying off the banks, the German banks, if there was any wavering from that, that these consequences would be unimaginably dire. Well, 3 years ago, 3 years later, things are unimaginably dire, and I think that the Greek people, a very large portion of them, came to the conclusion that it couldn't, whatever happens, it couldn't be any worse than sticking with this self, these self-inflicted wounds year after year, month after month, day after day. All right, so what is the big picture here? The big picture is that the euro crisis as a whole, and in particular the crisis in Greece, was a result of Germany's mercantilist policies generated through an agreement of trade unions, big business, and the government. This is what caused the euro crisis. Second, Greece was the most vulnerable country, and its debt and deficit problem would have been easily solved without a crisis if the German government had been prepared to have its own banks absorb some of the losses. But they weren't. That there would be no losses for German banks. The losses would be out of the hide of the Greek population. Later in another program, I'll talk about what the simple solution would have been back in the summer of 2010, the easy solution to not only the Greek crisis, the entire euro crisis, and we wouldn't be where we are now. But that is for another program. I want to now spend the last few minutes talking about the impact of this victory by Syriza. Does the debt crisis in Greece have any relevance for Britain? Well, in 2010, soon after the election in May, George Osborne, the new chancellor, certainly thought there were lessons there, and the lesson that he saw was that unless he embarked upon a courageous and dedicated reduction in the British budget deficit, that Britain would end up like Greece, with a collapsing economy and a possible default on its debt. And to save Britain from that dire outcome, there was no alternative. The only thing to be done was to get the deficit down. And the way to get the deficit down was not to raise taxes, but to lower expenditure, and in particular to lower expenditure on social programs. Now, there's a general rule that might be stated as follows. A disaster that results from a huge mistake demonstrates the fallacy of the same mistake when made in milder form. George Osborne's argument that the British deficit and debt were a problem that could lead to the collapse of British creditworthiness was absolute nonsense. There is no truth in it whatsoever. It is idiocy. That's easily explained. Greece's problem, the problem of the Greek government, which would become the problem of the Greek people, was that it owed its public debt in a currency it did not control. The euro was was controlled by the European Central Bank, and the Central Bank of Greece could not issue euros. So therefore, if the Greek government wanted to spend in excess of its income, then it had to borrow from private banks because it couldn't, in effect, print euros. Britain has its own currency. It can never default because it can always issue more bonds. And if British bonds are brought to the market to be redeemed for pounds, all the British government has to do is to borrow from the Bank of England to buy back those bonds. George Osborne also argued that, like Greece, Britain didn't do something about its deficit. It would find itself in a situation in which it was having to borrow at astronomical interest rates. So the Greek borrowing rate went above, I think at one point, above 20%. And that's what Britain would face if we didn't get the deficit down. Again, complete nonsense. A country with its own currency need never fear market speculators driving up the rate of interest. The reason they don't, you don't have to fear that, is because the British government can issue bonds at, say, 1% and buy those bonds itself. So there can never be a shortage or a surplus of bonds that would drive the interest rate up or down. It is completely determined by the Bank of England. When you have your own currency, there are problems, but default and runaway interest rates are not among them. Okay, that's the first point to make. George Osborne was misrepresenting, to the point of mendacity, the situation of the British economy. The British economy had its own currency. It didn't have to worry about default. It didn't have to worry about high interest rates on bonds. In addition, people should be aware that of the British debt, 30% of it is owed by the government to itself, to nationalized corporations or to parts of the government, and the most important one being the Bank of England, which the British government owns. It holds about 24-25% of the British debt. So even the whole debt doesn't have to be serviced for practical purposes because we owe it to ourselves. So if the public debt is not a problem that we need to worry about, and if there was no great need to rapidly drive down a deficit in that summer of 2010, and certainly no need to cut basic public services, what was and what is austerity all about? Austerity is about undermining, weakening, and gutting the public sector in order to provide more space for private profit-making. George Osborne is pursuing that policy with singular dedication, and it represents the economics of the 1%, not the economics of the 99%. Thank you, and I'll be talking to you next week again about austerity and the economics of the 99%. Thank you. I've seen my brothers working throughout this mighty land.
together, and together make a stand. Then we might own those banks of marble, with a guard at every door. And we would share those vaults of silver,